Hello, welcome to another episode of Turkey Book Talk. I'm William Armstrong, and in this podcast I talk to authors about newly released books on Turkey and its neighbourhood. You can subscribe through iTunes, Podbean, Stitcher or Acast, like the Facebook page or follow the Twitter account at Turkey Book Talk, and check out the show notes and other links at armstrongwilliam.wordpress.com. You can directly support this podcast if you want by taking advantage of a special offer for Turkey Book Talk listeners, courtesy of Hearst Publishers. In that offer, you can get a 33% discount plus free delivery on any one of five excellent books published by Hearst. Check it out via the address hearstpublishers.bigcartel.com. That's hearstpublishers.bigcartel.com. Purchasing through that deal is cheaper than Amazon, and more importantly for me, it helps support this podcast. Titles included on the list are written by authors who have featured on Turkey Book Talk at some point. They include The Circassian, A Life of Eshref Bey, Late Ottoman Insurgent and Special Agent by Benjamin Fortner, The New Turkey and Its Discontents by Simon Waldman and Emre Çalışkan, The Poisoned Well, Empire and Its Legacy in the Middle East by Roger Hardy, Out of Nowhere, The Syrian Kurds in Peace and War by Michael Gunter, and Jihad and Death, The Global Appeal of Islamic State by Olivier Roy. So to order any of those titles for a third off plus free delivery, visit hearstpublishers.bigcartel.com and help support Turkey Book Talk. Another way to support, if you enjoy or benefit from this podcast, is through my Patreon account, which lets you pledge a small or large donation on a per episode basis. The standard donation is $3 per episode, but you can contribute as much or as little as you want. You can find details of that Patreon account through all the Turkey Book Talk pages. But now let's get on with this latest episode, and in it I speak to Douglas Howard. He's Professor of History at Calvin College in Michigan, and the author of a new history of the Ottoman Empire, published by Cambridge University Press, called A History of the Ottoman Empire. The book was published earlier this year, and it's the first single-volume history of the Ottomans to appear in quite a while. In little over 300 pages, the book covers the more than 600-year history of the empire, from its 13th-century origins in the Balkans and western Anatolia, to its long, violent, cataclysmic dissolution at the start of the 20th century. The Ottoman Empire was essentially a pre-modern state that managed to persist for so long through reform and skillful geopolitical manoeuvring. The Ottoman ruling family enjoyed the longest span of uninterrupted dynastic sovereignty in world history, but they also had to contend with huge upheavals, wars, mutinies, scandals, riots, disasters, and epidemics. Howard gives an account of all these things, but the book is also punctuated by boxes and appendices giving useful detours on various other points of interest, cultural products, travelogues, Sufi poetry, and memoirs. I started by asking Douglas Howard to explain why he wanted to write this book at this time.
I had in mind the idea of writing a book like this from when I was a graduate student. I was just interested in the challenge of writing a narrative history of the Ottoman Empire in a single volume. I never started it and didn't have any plans to do it until Cambridge came to me at a professional meeting and asked me if I'd be interested in the project, and I was right away. So it was really the publisher's idea that the time was right for such a thing. I'm not sure even why they came to me. Maybe others had turned down the project. I'm not really sure about that. And I had written a history of Turkey before, which maybe demonstrates an interest in a narrative sort of approach. Maybe that was part of it.
Now, obviously, it's a very intimidating subject, really, because you're covering a 600-year-plus sweep of history with an extraordinarily diverse political landscape over that time. Did you find any particular challenges as you were doing the research for the book that you weren't anticipating before you set out to write it?
All of my colleagues agree with you there about how intimidating the project is to write a history of the empire from start to finish in a single volume. And it's especially the case that most of us in the field of Ottoman history work either on the first 300-400 years of the empire or the last 200-300 years of the empire. And there seems to be some sort of barrier in the 1700s that keeps people from working on both. And so it was a challenge for me as a person who had written mostly about the period of the 1500s and 1600s. It was a challenge for me to venture into that later period and then to try to, you know, to find common themes across that bridge. That was difficult.
There's a kind of popular view, really, that there was a kind of Pax Ottomana, really. Indeed, that's often the case when anyone looks back at any historical empires, really, seeing them as upholding the peace, etc. But what really comes across in this book is just how, you know, Ottoman territory was so often the site of upheaval, wars, rebellions, riots and disasters and epidemics and whatnot. It was all far from plain sailing, and that's something that really comes across in this book, I think.
I wanted to write about the sources of people's pain and suffering. And of course, at some level, the empire of the Ottomans, like that of the Safavids or like that of the Mughals or the Ming, did bring a kind of overarching order to a large territory with intrusive authority. But that always came at a cost. And so the empires always have their discontents. And I wanted to bring that out. And then even for the victors, even for the state servants, even for the elites, our lives as human beings are full of difficulty of all kinds. And I tried to write about that because that seems to me to be what is interesting about the historical past for any contemporary reader.
And also, it was a very violent space. You write at one point, quote, violence or the threat of violence was almost routine as a means of negotiating political change. And in such constant political turmoil, the Ottoman sultans often appeared to have very little day-to-day political or military authority. And that kind of cuts against the grain, really, of a lot of cliched ideas about the Ottoman Empire, how it was just almost a kind of pre-modern despotic system where everything was under the control of a single sultan. Really, you show how it was a lot more sophisticated than that.
It was an agrarian age empire, and it's easier for us to forget when we use terms like absolutism, that in the age before modernity and modern methods of communication, it was difficult for agrarian age states to really be able to control moment by moment what was happening in provinces very distant from a capital. Of course, they could learn about them from reports, and there was ultimately the threat of force. But their actual day-to-day ability to control events was limited by technology and travel.
I mean, how much control did the central government actually have? I mean, it's always a question I wonder about. When you see like maps of the Ottoman territory at any particular date, you always see this kind of big block of color, as if everything, you know, is that simple. Whereas you kind of make the point throughout the book that they were very often relying on local authorities at various points. And I think I've penned a quote here that you say Istanbul found itself relying on hundreds of mini despots all over the empire. And it just kind of shows you the very decentralized nature of a lot of authority at the time. I mean, it was a real paradox that really comes across in the book.
When you read the decrees of the sultans, they can be very direct and intimidating, and they often contain threats for retaliation if the decree's not carried out, you know, if the orders aren't carried out. Yet, on the other hand, the correspondence between provinces and the center shows that, in fact, there was quite a bit of negotiating room for local people to present their needs to the authorities and get them addressed.
Obviously, the Ottoman territory is very famous for being extraordinarily diverse, you know, religiously, linguistically, culturally. But something that also really comes through in the book is the real centrality of Islam in the empire. And sometimes it's kind of downplayed in a lot of histories. You know, people cite various things as the kind of non-Islamic sources of various state practices, which is also, of course, true. But you really do make this point that Islam and the idea of the Muslim community was really central to the practice, beliefs and the motivations of the authorities throughout Ottoman history. Was that a kind of deliberate thing that you set out to do, or was it just something that came through as you were researching?
I agree with you that often the role of religion is not clearly expressed in Ottoman histories. But to me, you have to, I wanted to write about the Ottoman worldview, and that worldview was fused with an Islamic point of view. you can't understand, to me, you can't understand the Ottomans without understanding that they were, that the dynasty was a Muslim dynasty, and that they looked at things from an Islamic point of view. At the same time, at least half the population of the empire for a very long time, for centuries, was not Muslim. They were Christians and Jews and others. And even the Muslim community was not monolithic. There were Shia Muslims, there were Sunni Muslims, there were many variations of each of those, and there were Alevis and others. So the dynasty was certainly Muslim, but that did not mean that it imposed a kind of uniformity on the population. But yes, I wanted to write about the Ottoman worldview. To me, that it's impossible to do that without talking a lot about religion.
It's also, of course, surprising sometimes to kind of remember that the Ottoman Empire was, until the 16th century, it wasn't even a Muslim majority state. It was the territories that were ruled by the Ottoman sultans were still majority non-Muslim until the early 16th century.
Right. And the shift in the balance of the population towards Islam occurred fairly late, and even as late as the 1880s, when the first real Ottoman census figures can be looked at, there, even then, the population was only about 75% Muslim.
One thing that I found really surprising that I can't remember if I actually knew before, but you write at one point that no Ottoman sultan ever made the Hajj. Why was that? Was there a particular reason for that, or a practical reason?
That's a good question, and I never encountered an answer to it. The one sultan who talked openly about making the Hajj was discredited by that kind of talk. And so, but I don't understand why that never happened, to be honest.
Also, what really comes through is this very obvious point, but it also sometimes gets lost in a lot of popular narratives today. It's how, from the beginning, really, the Ottoman center of gravity was really in Rumelia or Eastern Europe. It wasn't really centered in Anatolia. You know, all kinds of political changes originated in Rumelia, and, you know, it was always seen as the kind of Ottoman heartland far more than Anatolia. It's easy to kind of miss that point when we look back with hindsight.
Right. In lists of Ottoman provinces, Rumelia was always the first one listed, and Anadolu, Anatolia, was the second. Even Anatolia, however, the concept of Anatolia has changed over time, and the current usage of Anatolia as the entire peninsula between the Black Sea, Aegean, and Mediterranean, encompassing what we today would think of as the Republic of Turkey, is a modern usage. So to think of Anatolia and Turkey as synonymous is a 20th century idea. Before that, Anatolia was a small province that comprised the western part of current Turkey and the northwestern parts. The Anatolian plateau, so to speak, was divided between a couple of different provinces, Rum and Karaman.
You mentioned before about how the focus was really related to this idea of worldview that you were trying to get across. And one thing that does is you're kind of trying to probe the perspectives and motivations of people at the time as they saw it. And that kind of precludes imposing a kind of narrative on the history that you're telling. So there's no kind of idea of the Ottoman Empire's rise and slow decline. You know, that's a kind of classic narrative that we see in a lot of popular histories. But you kind of don't look back with hindsight and try and impose this kind of thing. It's far more of an open-ended sense of research that I think comes across in the book.
Right. I wanted to write about worldview, and worldview is a complicated thing. It involves parts of ourselves that we really have no choice in making, and it involves our connection in the world around us that's built for us. You know, but right, I wanted to write about worldview. I wanted really to avoid that narrative arc of the rise and fall of the empire. So I looked for ways to do that. And one way that I lit upon was how I divided the book. So the periodization of the book. And what I did was I made every chapter a century in the Islamic terms, so that no period of the Ottoman Empire gets more emphasis than any other period. To me, all people's lives are important, and all periods of history are important in their own way. And so I wanted to not zero in on, for example, the Empire of Suleiman as some kind of classical expression of things, or I wanted to avoid zeroing in on the period of the 1800s as somehow decrepit. I wanted to avoid those things because I think they're misleading.
Nevertheless, the decline and fall of the empire is, of course, key. And you talk about there being what you describe as the War of Ottoman Dissolution, basically from 1908 to 1923, so a kind of 15-year process, really. And this was a long period encompassing the Balkan Wars, the First World War, and then the War of Independence that led to the declaration of the Turkish Republic. And of course, this was an extraordinary, cataclysmic and violent time in which the political order was completely transformed. And it's also very difficult to kind of write about this era. I mean, just talk about how you wanted to approach it in the book. Was it kind of the most intimidating period of time to write about, or was it easy in your view?
It was difficult. It was the hardest part of the book to write, that last section, because of the extraordinary violence that it involves. And, of course, all periods of history are violent. That's human history. But that period of the first 25 years of the last century, that just to me stands out as a strikingly violent period in southwestern Asia. And so I knew that I had to write about the Armenian genocide. I knew I had to write about the Balkan Wars. I knew I had to write about military defeat on the Eastern Front and so on. And I knew that many readers would be very interested in that and might even go to that part of the book first. And I wanted to somehow find a way to convey the human misery of that time while also pointing out that there was nothing inevitable about it, that people made choices and did things that brought this about. There was, to me, as of 1908, 1909, 1910, absolutely no reason why the Ottoman Empire could not have continued another century. Of course, it would have been a very different kind of place, but it was specific events and specific choices by specific people that led to that violent cataclysm. And the sadness of it, as I worked over the evidence, just struck me, and I wanted to be able to bring that out.
Obviously, there was a kind of political transformation at the time, but also there were very many continuities that generally get less attention in the popular view. I mean, what would you say are some of the major, you've written a history of Turkey, what would you say are some of the major continuities from the Ottoman era to the Republican era that are still salient today?
Wow, difficult question, and I might not be the best person to answer it, but certainly people's ideas of their place in the world change very slowly. People's ideas and concepts of authority change slowly. And so it's perhaps not hard to see in the late Ottoman period the seeds of republican notions of what democracy was, what guided democracy was. The continuity of the constitutional periods strikes me. And the very, very late notion of a kind of ethnic unity to the idea of the nation certainly continues from the late Ottoman period into the Republic, and all of the difficulty and conflict that involves.
Now, whenever I get the chance to speak to kind of serious academic Ottoman historians, I'm always kind of intrigued what you make of the kind of current popular image of the empire in today's Turkey, because there's a kind of been a real transformation in the image of the Ottoman Empire in the last maybe 30 years. And today we see this, tempted to say, misrepresentation of what the empire was in favor of a kind of politicized image, basically, that emerges out of contemporary political concerns. And this kind of misrepresentation really does lose all the subtlety and the really fascinating reality of the empire as it actually was. Just wonder what you make of all this, as you survey the kind of shift that's happened in the popular understanding of the empire in today's Turkey.
Really good question. Again, I might not be the best one to answer it. I don't live in Turkey. I'm aware of some of the trends that are here. I've watched some of the episodes of, you know, the dramas and so on. But my impression is that at least in the 90s and maybe the first 10 years of this century, people had a kind of nostalgia for empire. So the popularity of late Ottoman times particularly expressed some kind of need to build a historical identity that was older than just a century. And there was interest in preserving Ottoman buildings and wearing Ottoman clothes again. And there was interest even in what Ottoman cuisine was like. So I think I would call that a kind of nostalgia. I'm less maybe adept at talking about the politics of that because I don't live here and don't read it and live it every day.
And also, just finally, I wonder if you could, as you have just spent years researching this book, I mean, is there any particular Ottoman sultan who you particularly are fond of, and is there any particular era of the huge sweep of Ottoman history that you particularly enjoyed researching?
Oh wow, thanks. That's a great question. I like the stories that I was able to tell in the book about Sultan Murad IV. Wow, he had such a reputation for violence, ruthlessness, and at the same time, the stories that Evliya Çelebi particularly tells about him are humorous and human. So I think I like his contrasts, his extremes, the sense of humor and the incredible and indescribable violence that he sometimes perpetrated.
What about an era?
You know, I've spent a long time before I wrote the book writing about the 1600s, 1700s. I think I understand maybe because of that, I understand that period a little better than the rest. But at the same time, in walking around Istanbul, I notice the city that was the early 20th century city. I would love to read somebody's book who could write about Istanbul in 1900. You know, there's a whole literature of the empires around the turn of the century, the turn of the 20th century. There's one written about Vienna. There's one written about Budapest. It would be great to have a colleague, you know, write a book called like Istanbul 1900. I think that'd be fascinating.
There you go. Laying down the gauntlet for anyone who wants to take on that project. Many thanks to Douglas Howard for joining the podcast this week. Check out my review of A History of the Ottoman Empire at Hurriyet Daily News. Remember, Turkey Book Talk listeners can support the podcast and get a 33% discount plus free delivery by purchasing any one of 5 books from Hearst Publishers as part of a special offer. To check out the books available in that deal, visit the special page for it, hearstpublishers.bigcartel.com. Another way to support is via my Patreon account, pledging a small or large donation on a per episode basis. Many thanks to current supporters Celia Jocelyn Kerslake, Michelle Zimmer, Jan Marcus Vommel, Steve Bryant, Aaron Ataman, Max Hoffman, and Andrew McDowell. Also, don't forget to rate or review Turkey Book Talk on whatever platform you listen on, which helps flag it up for other potential listeners. Follow via Twitter or like that Facebook page to stay updated with new episodes, and email recommendations, feedback, or abuse to williamjohnarmstrong@gmail.com. And while you're at it, let me know what you think about this new theme music. But until the next episode in a couple of weeks, thank you very much for listening.